Sweet.
Claire and Ayla.
Yeah, I think if I could say anything, it would be really, you're not alone, because there's a surprising community out there, and especially in this day and age of remote communication. So many of my experiences I felt I was alone in having. It's like everyone in the spouses group going through the same thing, and it was such a relief to know that not only was I not alone, but we had ways to make things work, and that was so hopeful for me, especially when things were hard. So yeah, not alone. There's some great people out there going through the same things.
Thank you. You've been listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. We've been talking about spouses and couples who are in transition, where one of the partners has come out as transgender within the couple. And we've been joined with Shannon Batts, counselor, who helps work with those people, and with Jean and Claire, with Jean and Nicolette and Marcy Grace. So thank you all for joining us, and we will see you again in 2 weeks. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, what a great conversation. Yay.
Thank you, everyone.
You.
It was great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Hey, KBOO listeners. Today is another Big Give Day on Give Guide. Today only, when you donate $10 or more to KBOO on Give Guide, you'll get a chance to win a Trek bicycle, courtesy of the Bike Gallery. For your chance to win and to support KBOO today, go to kboo.fm/give.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, President Donald Trump on Monday announced by tweet that Attorney General William Barr had submitted his resignation letter and that he would be leaving office 1 month ahead of his expected departure. Trump claimed, "Our relationship has been a very good one. He has done an outstanding job," end of quote. Even though the resignation came after weeks of reporting that Trump was itching to fire Barr, angry that he didn't echo the president's demonstrably false claims of mass illegal voting. Trump also announced that Deputy Attorney General Jeff Rosen would take over Barr's duties. Barr's resignation letter, akin to a love letter to the president, was filled with praise for Trump. He lauded him for a, quote, historic record, accomplished, quote, in the face of relentless, implacable resistance. He spent much of his letter attacking the president's critics and exaggerating his accomplishments in a manner very similar to Trump himself. Mr. Barr leaves behind a legacy marred by his obvious political loyalty to Trump, in an office that's meant to be nonpartisan, leading his critics to characterize him as the president's personal lawyer rather than the nation's top prosecutor. We'll be examining Barr's legacy in more detail on our program. In other news, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's Vaccine Safety Panel has deemed a second company's product to be safe and effective. Moderna, a U.S. company that uses a similar technology to Pfizer BioNTech to develop its vaccine, has just passed the FDA's initial step that all but ensures formal emergency approval. The FDA is expected to make its decision by Friday, after which Moderna has plans to deliver 6 million doses. Although surveys indicate that American vaccine skepticism is falling, the Kaiser Family Foundation reported this week that about a quarter of all Americans vow not to take the shots. Vaccine skeptics include African Americans, rural white Americans, and Republicans, who likely have different reasons for their reticence. Internationally, Western nations have sparked an arms race for vaccines, clearing out stocks before poorer nations can access them. In fact, some nations are hoarding supplies that far outnumber their populations, in particular Canada, which has reserved enough vaccines for four times the number of its residents. The U.S. is close to procuring twice as many vaccine doses as residents. The death toll from COVID-19 continues to rise, hitting the grim milestone of 300,000 here in the United States, with one American dying every minute from the virus. The past month has seen a whopping 50,000 deaths alone. The Trump administration has taken a vaccine-only approach to the disease. While hope is on the horizon, there are likely to be hundreds of thousands more dead before the vaccines reach enough people to stop the spread. The disease has spread like wildfire through the White House and Trump's orbit, sickening untold numbers of people. Among them is Creed Bailey, director of the White House Security Office, who got so sick he had to be hospitalized for 3 months and suffered an amputation of his lower leg. Bailey, who apparently asked the White House to keep his condition a secret, now has mounting medical bills over which friends have started a crowdfunding campaign. Meanwhile, Tuesday is the last day for Americans to sign up for open enrollment at healthcare.gov to take advantage of an Obamacare healthcare plan. Trump failed in his attempt to repeal and replace the signature law. Interest in new signups during the pandemic has reportedly been high. On Monday, electors from all over the nation cast votes to reflect their state's election results, officially naming Joe Biden as president-elect. As voting took place, Trump, who remains resolute in his refusal to concede, spent the day rage-tweeting claims like rigged election and massive fraud. Mr. Biden gave a speech, saying it was time for the nation to turn the page on the Trump chapter.
Very few predicted, even thought possible, the biggest voter turnout in the history of the United States of America. A number so big that this election now ranks as the clearest demonstration of the true will of the American people. One of the most amazing demonstrations of civic duty we've ever seen in our country. It should be celebrated, not attacked. More than 81 million of those votes were cast for me and Vice President-elect Harris. That too is a record. More than any ticket has received in the history of America.
That's President-elect Joe Biden giving a speech on the day that electors across the nation cast their votes, giving him 306 Electoral College votes. He chastised Trump for refusing to concede even after Trump tried and failed every avenue to win at his, quote, unprecedented assault on our democracy.
Thankfully, a unanimous Supreme Court immediately and completely rejected this effort. The court sent a clear signal to President Trump that they would be no part of an unprecedented assault on our democracy. Every single avenue was made available to President Trump to contest the results. He took full advantage of each and every one of those avenues. President Trump was denied no course of action he wanted to take. He took his case to Republican governors and Republican Secretary of State, as he criticized many of them, to Republican state legislatures, to Republican-appointed judges at every level.
That's President-elect Joe Biden on Monday. After refusing to acknowledge Biden's win for weeks, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on Tuesday finally congratulated him, as did Russian President Vladimir Putin. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is now scheduled to meet Antony Blinken, his likely successor, marking the first formal recognition by the Trump administration that its time in power is over. The battle to back Trump in his coup attempt, or not, has thrown the Republican Party into disarray as two sides battle one another. As negotiations over COVID-19 economic relief continue, Democrats are facing accusations of caving in to Republican pressure, dropping their demands for local and state government aid to be included in the package. They have backed a bill that will set aside only $748 billion, the larger of two bills that a $908 billion package was broken into. Meanwhile, the second part of that bill that combines local and state aid with McConnell's demand to protect corporations from liabilities includes retroactive immunity from worker lawsuits. Worker advocates slammed the provisions. California-based groups are worried that that aspect of the bill could undo the state's worker protections. Missing from all bills are the $1,200 stimulus checks for Americans. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders released a statement saying, quote, Congress cannot go home for the Christmas holidays until we pass legislation which provides a $1,200 direct payment to working-class adults, $2,400 for couples, and a $500 payment to their children. This is what Democrats and Republicans did unanimously in March through the CARES Act. This is what we have to do today. Sanders' sentiment is echoed by Republican Senator Josh Hawley. In other news, the New York Times on Tuesday reported that corporate TV networks like CNN and MSNBC are worried about their ratings in a post-Trump future. The president's aberrant behavior and violent rhetoric has made for a ratings boon for media entities. The paper spoke with numerous staff members of the two networks who shared their concerns. In international news, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani on Tuesday announced that he was willing to re-enter the Iran nuclear agreement during Biden's tenure, the same agreement that the Obama administration negotiated and that Trump decimated once in office. Mr. Rouhani said at a press conference in Tehran, "What can be on the table is that everyone will return to their full commitments." Referring to the crippling sanctions that Trump imposed, Rouhani added, "I believe that the era of the economic war has come to an end." And that does it for our headlines. We'll be back with the rest of the program after this break. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up at Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Attorney General William Barr will leave office just before Christmas, as per a tweet by the president on Monday. For Barr to leave office barely a month before his slated departure indicates Donald Trump's displeasure with a man who has been one of his most loyal foot soldiers. While Barr has bent over backwards to fit U.S. law and ethical standards to Trump's needs, apparently overturning the election's results was a step too far, even for him. Trump had publicly chastised Barr for not supporting his demonstrably false claims of illegal voting. During his time as Attorney General, Mr. Barr made waves for acting more like the president's personal lawyer than the nation's top prosecutor. Joining me to discuss what he leaves behind at the DOJ is Caroline Fredrickson, distinguished visitor from practice at Georgetown University Law Center. She served as the president of the American Constitution Society from 2009 to 2019. She also served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office and as general counsel and legal director of NARAL Pro-Choice America. Welcome to the program, Caroline.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
It was interesting to see that William Barr came into office because Jeff Sessions, his predecessor, was fired for not towing the Trump line. Sessions refused to recuse himself from the Mueller investigation, or rather insisted on recusing himself from the Mueller investigation, and Trump was pretty upset about that. Sessions left. Do you see Barr's departure as in the same vein of having displeased this dictatorial president, and so now he's out the door?
It's really ironic because, as you mentioned in the introduction, Bill Barr has done everything possible to please this president. I mean, and let's face it, he was pleasing himself because he had an ideology that is extremely far to the right that believes that the president basically can do no wrong. The irony is that that he himself is going to be asked to pack his bags before the end of this term. He did go as far as anyone possibly could, but even Bill Barr couldn't manufacture evidence that didn't exist.
So let's talk about what marked him and his legacy. During the hearings for his Senate confirmation, the fact that he had essentially written a letter to an open letter to Trump as sort of vying for the job, and the fact that he had held these views about excessive executive power seemed to be sort of brushed under the rug. Even Democrats voted for him, I assume naively supposing that he wouldn't go as far as he said he wanted to go. So he came into office almost as an open book, and he did sort of end up playing out that ideology that people feared, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he laid it out, and he has a history, right? I mean, he was involved with the pardoning of the Iran-Contra criminals. He has long believed in this extremely excessively broad vision of executive power, president as king, essentially. And he laid it out all in that letter to Donald Trump saying, you know, by definition, the president cannot obstruct justice. The Mueller investigation is wrongly, has no basis. I'm going to come in and I'm going to give you everything you want. And so it was all there. And it's really incomprehensible that the Democratic senators did not push on these issues because they weren't secret. They were there for anybody who bothered to ask about them. And Barr has lived up to all of the worst fears that anybody could have had about him.
Was Bill Barr the reason why Trump so successfully convinced so many Americans that the Mueller investigation completely exonerated him?
Absolutely. He was certainly one of the major architects of that argument by suppressing the full report from ever being seen, but even from suppressing Mueller's own synopsis from being publicly available until Barr had himself presented a version of it that was very misleading and shaped the coverage of the Mueller report thereafter, in which he essentially said there was no finding of obstruction and no finding of conspiracy with the Russians. It's not at all what the Mueller report said. The Mueller report said simply that it was the job of Congress because of the opinion written by the Office of Legal Counsel in which it says that basically a president can't be indicted while he's president, which we can contest, and I hope it will be changed. But so he was leaving it to Congress to make the decision on obstruction. On conspiracy, he lamented the big problem is conspiracy requires intent, and they never got an interview with Trump. And so, well, they had, so many contacts with the Russians and so much evidence about interactions that could have stood for a conspiracy charge. They didn't have the element of intent that's required for the proof. And that was really a devastating report from the perspective of Trump, had the people actually known what it said.
Then he also went on to exonerate so many of Trump's own allies and friends. The investigation against Michael Flynn was dropped. Roger Stone was let out of prison. Those were also basically gifts to Trump, right?
Right. And he intervened in a way that was so completely counter to the history of the Justice Department. And the idea is that the prosecutors are supposed to be following the evidence, bringing the charges, pursuing the prosecution, and they did that, and they were successful. And it was only after they got these convictions that Barr swoops in and undoes them. After tweets by Donald Trump and a recognition that as servile as he is, that Barr would get better, would be liked better and supported better by the president if he actually went in and committed this very unprecedented act of undoing prosecutions by his own Department of Justice.
There's also the issue of William Barr's role in the Portland unrest. During this past year, we had seen this massive national uprising starting first in cities like Minneapolis, where George Floyd was killed by police, spreading to cities like Seattle and Portland, New York City, Los Angeles. And William Barr, shouldn't we see as part of his legacy the unleashing of federal troops, armed federal troops on ordinary Americans? He did it in D.C. as well, in the nation's capital.
Oh, absolutely, and more. You know, also as somebody who contests the idea that there is actually a problem with racism in America.
And that's right. He said it in a hearing.
He contests the idea that there's any racism in policing, and he set up a policing commission that had nobody on it except police. The law enforcement side, nobody from the civil rights community, nobody who suffered at the hands of brutal police officers. And so he not only allowed a president to be described in the media as completely innocent after a very thorough investigation by Bob Mueller that showed everything to the contrary, but also he has a legacy of bringing out force against peaceful protesters in America and really undermining the fight for racial justice. And it's hard to think of a worse attorney general. I thought when there was Jeff Sessions, that would be the rock bottom, but clearly there was lower to go.
Hmm. So essentially acting as Trump's personal lawyer and then this so-called tough on crime approach, which he has then cemented by resuming the federal death penalty after years-long effective moratorium. Bill Barr leaves office signing off on the executions of 5 death row inmates, 2 of whom have already been killed. This, too, should be part of his ugly legacy, right?
Oh, you know, it's hard to list all of the things. It really depresses me just to think through all of the things in addition to the spurious arguments in favor of what they call religious liberty, which is really the ability to discriminate against Americans on the basis of their gender identity or their transgender or otherwise. And yet, you know, he claims himself to be a man of faith. He's willing to execute people at a fast clip. And discriminate against other people. And, I just ask, where is the faith in that?
It's worth stopping to remind our audience and ourselves of what the DOJ and the role of Attorney General is supposed to be. I mean, under Trump, so much that simply was not tolerated before has become normalized. What would be, although a president appoints an attorney general, what is supposed to be the relationship between a president and an attorney general? Since Nixon, we haven't seen this much sort of politicization of that office, right?
Oh, well, indeed. And, you know, it is worth stepping back for a second to think about how it's constructed. One of the things that Donald Trump's presidency has uncovered for so many of us, and not just in the area of the Department of Justice and its own internal processes, but more broadly, is the fact that we don't have a lot of legal limits on the president abusing the public trust. A lot of what we have been depending on are norms, are accepted ways of behaving. And unfortunately, a lot about the Department of Justice has been observed in that way. The president does appoint the attorney general. In other administrations, they've adopted internal rules that set very strict limits between political people and prosecutors in terms of what kinds of investigations and what prosecutions were appropriate to bring so that you wouldn't have undue political influence on that part of the Department of Justice's work. Obviously, they do policy work as well, and there's going to be more engagement from the White House and from the political appointees in those areas. But in terms of the law enforcement side, that was supposed to be a pretty bright red line that separated the two. And when I did work in the White House, and there was a very high level policy that would bar any conversations between the White House and prosecutors over certain kinds of subjects. But now we know that there's no way to enforce that, that it was dependent on the White House itself and on the Department of Justice adopting and following an internal rule process. So there are many of us who've been engaged in conversations about what kind of reforms are necessary and how do we strengthen the independence of the Department of Justice. You know, some of them can be done through legislation. Some of it can be done through stronger congressional oversight, but some of it we may need to think about, you know, going forward, if it's possible to make constitutional changes. I, for one, think that the Attorney General should be much more independent than is certainly has been the case under Donald Trump.
In addition to Barr refusing to go along with Trump's wild claims of illegal voter fraud, perhaps because there is no evidence of it, one of the other things that it seems has angered Trump was the fact that there has been this secret investigation, months-long investigation into Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, in some sort of tax investigation. And when Trump, when news of it was revealed, Trump apparently was deeply angry that that wasn't made public months ahead. And, you know, he didn't even try to sort of mince words when he made it clear that he would have loved to have politicized an investigation of Hunter Biden to his advantage ahead of the election. So I'm wondering if that too played a role in Trump essentially, you know, to fire your attorney general, which is effectively what it was, a firing a month before he's slated to leave. It's basically a slap in the face of William Barr. And I'm wondering if the Hunter Biden secret investigation was part of it.
No doubt. I mean, I'm sure there was a series of things that, you know, again, there, you know, I think Bill Barr, you know, he saw what, you know, the writing on the wall in terms of the election. I mean, he did, you know, he did suggest that there could have been fraud. I mean, he played along with the president's craziness. But at the end of the day, there was nothing he could do to actually change the outcome. And I think once he saw that writing on the wall for him, you know, there's really no upside to further tarnishing, well, I wouldn't say his legacy, because his legacy is already so tarnished, but to adding, you know, fuel to that fire, where being fired is, you know, at this point, what's the big deal for him? He goes home, spends the holidays with his family, and then, you know, and probably, as happens so often in D.C., he gets welcomed back into the elite legal community, whereas so many of us think he should be disbarred and run out of town. You know, the guy is practically a criminal himself for what he has done. But you know, as for him, I'm sure he's probably pretty pleased to be able to walk out now and not have to stick around for the last month of Looney Tunes out of the White House.
Right. There was a lot of talk among the legal community for impeaching Barr as Attorney General. And then you look at that resignation letter that Trump publicized that basically could have been written by Trump himself. Obsequious, cannot even begin to describe it. It clearly, Barr didn't go the way of John Bolton or General John Kelly, you know, one-time Trump loyalists who went out the door openly criticizing Trump. Barr is going out the door lauding Trump. He spent almost the entire letter praising everything Trump has done in the face of, you know, implacable resistance, relentless resistance, and it just was this love letter to Trump. Just, is it purely ideological for Bill Barr? I mean, he doesn't even seem to have much pride.
Well, I mean, Bill Barr got everything he wanted. So let's not forget that, you know, he looks like a lapdog to Donald Trump, but he was very much in control in terms of achieving policy outcomes that he desired. He has always wanted to have a souped up superpower presidency with excessively strong powers. He helped give that to Donald Trump to expand the concept of executive power. He has really, you know, he supports the extreme right-wing judges that Donald Trump nominated. He was part of the Federalist Society in grooming these judges who are turning our law back at a rapid pace when it comes to civil rights and civil justice, not to mention criminal justice, environmental law, everything else you could think of. They're turning the clock back and denying Americans' rights. There are a lot of things he's gonna say that he's really proud of, and so he can come out of there and say he got what he wanted. He really did.
Some have suggested that Bill Barr shouldn't be let off the hook just because he's leaving before Christmas. Are there mechanisms for accountability for an attorney general who, you know, so many people have acclaimed just broke aspects of the U.S. Constitution?
Well, I think, you know, history is going to be the best accountability here. And
you
think
so?
I don't really
trial
see
or prison time.
You know, we it wouldn't break my heart to see him marched off. Although, you know, I'm not for more incarceration, but
sure, yeah.
But let's face it, it's really hard to find something that you could actually charge him with. I think there are efforts, and there will be efforts to disbar him, to bring bar complaints, bar complaints against bar for unethical behavior. I don't know if those will be successful either, but I do think we have to remember that we cannot let this moment just go past us. Even if it's not memorialized by some kind of an official act of accountability, we the people have to hold these Trump and his cronies accountable through whatever mechanisms we have, and that is by denying them power. That's the best way to do it, and by undoing the damage that they've done to our country.
I imagine also invoking Barr's name in future Senate confirmation hearings of attorneys general that are enamored of presidential power, might become a good footnote in American history, not to be like Barr. Caroline, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sonali.
My guest has been Caroline Fredrickson. She is a distinguished visitor from practice at Georgetown University Law Center, and where she served as also the president of the American Constitution Society from 2009 to 2019. And we've been discussing the legacy of William Barr as Attorney General of the United States. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A recently published scientific article in Nature marked a little noticed yet grim planetary milestone. Its authors pointed out that, quote, Earth is exactly at the crossover point. In the year 2020, the anthropogenic mass, which has recently doubled roughly every 20 years, will surpass all global living biomass. In other words, we're at the point where the weight of all objects created by humans now equals the weight of all living creatures on the planet. Thinking about that the next time you throw out a broken lamp instead of trying to get it fixed is exactly the reason why my next guest wrote her book, Fixation, How to Have Stuff Without Breaking the Planet. Sandra Goldmark is the founder of Fix Up, formerly Pop-Up Repair, an innovative social enterprise in New York City. She's also a theater, set, and costume designer, a leader in the field of sustainable theatrical design, and director of the Sustainability and Climate Action Program, an associate professor of professional practice at Barnard College. She joins me to discuss her new book. Welcome to the program, Sandra.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you for having me.
So this study that I cited that was published in Nature is sort of remarkable when we think about how much stuff there is on the planet. We don't necessarily link that with that broken appliance that we're throwing out because we either don't have the time to get it fixed or it would be too expensive or we simply don't know how to fix it or where to take it to get it fixed. So tell me about your book and why you decided to write this. What took you on your journey to, you know, taking on this issue?
Thank you. I'll share that journey. I did want to say before I begin, I'm so glad you brought up that article because I read it too recently, and that was a statistic I was looking for the whole time I was researching the book. What is the total mass of stuff? I didn't know that the term was anthropogenic mass. I was calling it stuffomass as opposed to biomass.
The formal title, yeah.
That's right. It's actually stuffomass. But here it is. The study is out, and it's shocking, as you say. So yeah, that is a great backdrop for this little story. So in answer to your question of my journey towards this book, towards Fixation, began in about 2013 when I was home on maternity leave and a bunch of stuff broke in my house. Sort of random things, a lamp, a toaster, a backpack, a vacuum. And I thought, I wanted to get them fixed. I wanted them to work. And it was incredibly hard to get those very simple items fixed. And I think many people can relate to this. There's nowhere to go. The vacuum manufacturer suggested I drive out to Hackensack with my vacuum. And, you know, there I was at home with a newborn and a toddler. I wasn't gonna drive to Hackensack. So long story short, first I wrote a letter to Walmart and I was suggesting that they open a repair shop in the corner of every Walmart all over the world. And I showed the letter to my husband and he gently suggested that maybe we needed a little more evidence before we wrote to Walmart to get them to read our letter. I said, okay, fine. So long story short, we started opening repair shops here in New York. We would staff them with theater artists because we knew that in theater backstage, we both work backstage, you can fix things. Anything that needs to go out on stage gets fixed, gets altered, gets mended, and it goes out and it works. So we knew that it was possible to do this act of repair. And we wanted to see what would happen if we offered the service in our neighborhood. Would people show up? Would we be able to fix anything? Would they pay for the service? And that was the beginning of our little experiment, or our big experiment, since it lasted 7 years.
Here where I live in Pasadena, Southern California, there had been an effort called Repair Cafe, which I think is along similar lines. What was the response that you got? And I'm assuming this was sort of a free service of volunteers offering to fix stuff for no charge?
Actually, no, we charge. So that's the charged. Big difference between us and repair cafes.
I see.
We're sort of cousins. And I think for us, it was because we were very interested in the question of labor and the economy. What is the value of repair, the economic value of repair today? Will people pay for it? And if so, how much? Could a New Yorker pay their rent fixing things in this day and age? So it was very important for us as part of the experiment to pay. I think repair cafes are wonderful, and I think they're a really important part of the ecosystem. I think you need free services, DIY, community. You also need people. Some people need to be able to just drop something off and pay for it. It's kind of like food. You need to have healthy options from a multiplicity of points in the system.
And food,
so we charged.
The sort of revolutionizing of our thinking around food in about a decade or so ago is something that you borrow from when trying to explain the attitude that we kind of all have to adopt if we don't want to be drowning in broken stuff. Tell me about that. There was, I believe it was Michael Pollan, who at least made famous the simple mantra, when he tried to simplify how to explain to people about rules for eating. He said, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. So what's your analogy or analog around stuff?
So I thought, well, actually stuff is a lot like food, right? We take it from the earth, we transform it with our labor, and we bring it into our homes, or in the case of food, into our body. And like food, the way we make stuff and the way we consume it impacts our health, it impacts our happiness, and it impacts communities around the world where stuff is made, and of course the planet's ecological systems. So I thought, hey, look, this wrestling with food, I love the way Michael Pollan, for example, wrestled with the problems of food, but also acknowledged, and food systems, but acknowledged that food is a blessing and a joy and a fundamental part of the human experience. And I think stuff is the same. There are a lot of problems on the personal level and on the global level, but stuff is fundamental to the human experience. It's part of who we are. It's not going away. And actually, there are some simple ways that we can do it better. So again, looking to the food movement, which is more advanced than what I call the stuff movement, I adapted Michael Pollan's phrase for stuff. So it's have good stuff, not too much, mostly reclaimed, care for it, pass it on.
This notion that things, when they break, should simply be replaced with new things. Is that a relatively new notion? I feel like there are elders in our community that, you know, have said, well, in my day, when, you know, I bought a toaster, it lasted decades. Do things break more easily now?
They definitely do. Without a doubt, objects are less and less designed for longevity and for repair. It's kind of a negative feedback loop where we design things for a shorter life, so it's harder to fix, so the repair shops go out of business and the new stuff gets cheaper and more repair shops go out of business. And it is very new, and it's a particular, it's a trend that has actually started quite a long time ago. You know, you can place it as early as the 19th century or even before with some early mechanization processes. A lot of people place it after World War II, but it really started much earlier. And it's a process really where our capacity to make things has gotten so powerful that we can make a huge amount of stuff at an incredibly low price, of course, by taxing ecological systems and by underpaying people all over the world, but we can do it now.
So small financial price, but of course, large planetary price, large price in terms of human labor that's not properly compensated. This idea that stuff is being made that manufacturers know will not last very long has a name. It's called planned obsolescence. You single out, and many people around the world have singled out Apple Corporation for that. I mean, the new iPhone that, you know, comes out every couple of years, and whether or not your current iPhone is functioning just perfectly, there's the pressure to get the new iPhone. Meanwhile, obsolete iPhones pile up in e-waste, you know, arenas. So tell me about the corporations and their interest in continuing this planned obsolescence.
Yeah, so those steps that I laid out earlier, have good stuff, not too much, those are sort of written as if they're for an individual. But every step that I outline in the book essentially has lying within it a call to action for corporations and a challenge. Just like my little crazy letter to Walmart 7 years ago, which still stands, is the idea that corporations must, and in fact they already are, beginning to realize that the only sustainable business model of the future is one that will actually support these healthy actions, like support us in keeping our phones, support me in keeping my toaster. And yes, make me pay for it. I'd rather pay for the repair. And this is what we discovered in our shops. People are often willing to pay to keep the thing they already have. It's an amazing phenomenon. And our society today doesn't actually support or value that impulse. We only are supporting people's attraction to the shiny new thing. And in fact, we're fueling that attraction with advertising, with technological obsolescence, where things are designed to break. So companies, my book is really trying to make the case that we can and need to adapt our business models to include service, to include upgrades, modularity, and repair. And of course, sustainable and ethical design in the first place, right? Let's just name that.
how serious is the problem of, of landfills, of planetary destruction? I mean, that Nature article that I cited that you said you'd also read indicates that there are likely, these spaces on Earth that are now becoming uninhabitable because they are filled with stuff that we've thrown away. Landfills come to mind, but they are largely invisible from view, to those of us, going about our daily lives. Is part of the problem that we simply aren't being forced to face the consequences of this, of this economic design?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the question of climate change writ large. But I do agree that specifically in terms of consumption, I think there's a story that even within the larger climate change story needs to be told. So the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, the IPCC put out a study, and the Ellen MacArthur Foundation has a great quote about it where they say that, when we're talking about climate change, we talk a lot about renewables and energy efficiency, which is critically important. But unfortunately, even if like tomorrow we could flip a magic switch and switch over to renewables, to renewable energy, that would only account for 55% of global emissions. The other 45% can be traced back to consumption. So that's our food and our stuff. So it's a huge number of our emissions. If you look at the land and material impacts of consumption, it's enormous. If you look at it, maybe the stuff-o-mass statistic is the one that floats your boat, if you're a person who goes for statistics. But for me, one of the ways that I'm actually not a statistics person, they don't move me emotionally, but I include them in because for some people they are really
telling. They do move some people like me.
They do. They're really important. They're really important. But for the other people, I sometimes like to think like, there are other ways to perceive it, right? If you really open your eyes, if you look at the stores, if you look at the world you live in and walk around and really look and at the massive volume all around you, right? And think about the statistics that we read about the massive volume of life forms that are dying right now on this planet, the mass extinction, and you can feel and see that we're sort of transforming, now the Nature article confirms that we are transforming the natural world into a human-made product or series of human-made products. And for me, it's just heartbreaking.
I'm wondering if it's a sort of first world attitude that used things aren't as good as new things. I found it's coming as an immigrant into this country. This is purely a single person's anecdotal evidence that Americans born here had a greater aversion to stuff that's used, than my people. and I'm wondering if it is this first world attitude of, well, if it's used, it's not clean, it's dirty, I want something new and shiny.
I think there's some parts of it that are kind of universal, like everywhere a wonderful new thing is wonderful, but also on many, many places in the world, a wonderful old thing is wonderful. Like there's value in both. And in American society, I think that we don't see as much the value in the old, and we have trained ourselves to only, again, support the impulse to the new. Both impulses are really very, very normal and natural and common. And we've built a system today in America that prioritizes and places higher value on new. We also place, in terms of the work, we place less value on the work of care and stewardship and cleaning and fixing and caring. Is even the work of it gets lower value in our society than the work, let's say, of like making that new shiny thing.
Right.
So there is, I think, a deep value system underneath it that needs to be looked at.
I'm wondering if in your research you came across another, a similar grassroots effort to the fix-up shops you were talking about, the repair cafes, which is the Buy Nothing projects. I'm part of local one here in my neighborhood, and it's basically neighbors coming together to give each other stuff that they don't need. One man's, you know, trash is another person's treasure, and it's a thriving community. There are thriving such communities all over, and the idea of, you know, not buying stuff is right there in the title, and it seems to be pretty popular. You know, people, you know, have a pair of pillows that don't match your sofa anymore. Instead of tossing them, you give them to your neighbor who does have a penchant for your kind of stuff that you don't want.
Yeah, I think Buy Nothing groups, and there's all kinds of cousin organizations in every neighborhood, you know, parent listservs or PTA swaps or clothing swaps or just the person in your building or down the street who you give your kid's stroller to when you're done. Like this informal systems of exchange are actually incredibly powerful in many, many communities. And I think that there's something that we actually would do very well to study, to name, to honor, to amplify, to scale. I think traditional businesses need to look at that incredible thriving ecosystem. Not that I want, you know, people to always be spending money on these things, but I want to also transform the kind of traditional economy. You know, I want businesses to be making money off of exchange and reuse and repair, not just selling new stuff. So I think that, and again, as I said before, it's an ecosystem. I think we want these healthy activities in every sector, the neighborhood, the community, the small businesses, the Walmarts, and the policy level. And the places where it's the most interesting right now, as you point out, are these kind of community and informal groups like repair cafes, Buy Nothing, parent listservs. There's a lot of startups that are helping to build systems to make the logistics of all of that exchange easier. Because as you probably know from your Buy Nothing group, like it's a little bit of work. You got to meet the person, you got to text them and go to the corner. We want to make all that easier for people so that they can exchange their stuff freely and easily.
I'm wondering how you make the argument to somebody, particularly somebody who's already struggling financially, but needs stuff, because some stuff we do need. It's not just all about sort of luxuries and nice things that we want to have. It's basic things that people do need. I'm wondering how you make the economic argument, particularly in a country where wealth inequality keeps rising. You know, it's far too tempting to buy the cheap thing because then you have it right away and you simply can't afford the thing that is more expensive but may last longer.
Yeah, this is a really important and tough point because, so one of the things in my book, Step One, where I talk about have good stuff, my argument there is that when we're buying, making or buying new, we need to use better design, higher quality materials, and pay better labor wages. And that often, not always, but often does mean a higher price. Sometimes the prices are elevated and you're still not getting the good quality. So actually there are some times when you could, you know, have your cake and eat it too. But there are many moments where the price of new goods might in this system have to go up. And it raises all kinds of questions of access, right? Does that mean only wealthy people would have access to quality goods? That is not right. It raises questions, as you say, about how we can make it easier for people who don't have enough money to pay a higher upfront cost. Like, are there ways to structure payments? And for me, it also always comes back to understanding the system of stuff as more than just linear, right? Like, we're not only talking about the new materials. If we really work hard on repair, on service, and on reuse, we can create multiple access points for those high quality goods.
And of course, you bring in the issue of properly compensated labor. If that argument is applied across the board, we reduce wealth inequality, we start to close the gap between rich and poor, and then things do become more affordable. Wages do start rising. And so that part of the equation when it comes to the economy is critically important, right?
Yeah, it's the linchpin. It's the underlying point that you come back to in the whole conversation. It's, you know, look at my repair shops. Why is it hard for me to pay my fixers because I can only charge a certain amount for my repairs? Why? Because the new item is so cheap. Why? because the person who made the new item was not paid a living wage and not paid a wage that's at all comparable. And so you keep coming back to this question of international labor standards.
Basically. And so sustainability becomes something that's less within reach simply because we, you know, live in a capitalist world where a profit motive is placed above basic things like labor rights, human rights, etc. And that's a conclusion that the climate justice movement as a whole has come to, that, you know, many, at least many members of the or leaders in the climate justice movement have come to the conclusion that our current capitalist model of placing profits above all else is not just unsustainable from a financial perspective, but literally destroying the planet. So I'm wondering if you, have a closing for your story. You started out saying you wanted to write to Walmart about repair shops at every corner. And of course, for big corporations, if you can get stuff repaired, then it's less incentive for people to come into the store to buy new stuff. Did you ever end up writing to Walmart?
I never sent that letter, but I'll send them a copy of my book. It's all in there now. But I think that it actually can happen. I think there are some major pieces of the puzzle, like international labor standards, that have to happen, right? And those are not going to happen voluntarily by big corporations. That has to happen at the government level and at the international level. My only ray of hope there is that, you know, it's illegal right now to send, for example, a load of rotten meat across international borders, right? I can't ship a whole bunch of food that's poisonous across borders. Why am I allowed to ship material goods that were made for in unsafe or unfair conditions, right? It is possible to have these international standards for consumption. They do exist, again, in the world of food. Not to say that there's not labor problems in food globally, there are, but it is not inconceivable. And then the other thing I like to think about, again, a little bit more optimistic on the big corporation front, is it's actually starting to happen. All of these big players are looking at the circular economy. They know that their business model is unsustainable in the long run because it is only built on selling new stuff. And they know that the resources are going to run out and that the costs are going to go high. And so they are starting to look at ways to diversify that revenue stream. So that does give me hope.
One of the problems with our sort of fixation on buying new things is sort of inadvertently related to the old sustainability mantra of reduce, reuse, recycle. So many Americans fixated on the last one, the recycle part, and not as much on the reduce or reuse. And we have this mental, this idea at the back of our heads when we consume stuff that, oh, it'll get recycled when we throw it out. When we buy the stuff, it's in packaging that will get recycled. When we, you know, drink the water out of water bottles, that plastic will get recycled. And we know now that that's turned into a big fat lie because there's very little recycling actually happening, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's why in this book, I'm trying to sort of extend for people their understanding and knowledge of the full life cycle of an object, to be like, here's what it really means. You buy it, you bring it into your home, here's how you can use it, and to see that actually your relationship with that object is a little bit longer term, right? Like you actually made it or bought it, and you then are invested in seeing it through to another user in its own life. Like there's something about the kind of knee-jerk thing that you're describing of like, oh, it'll just get recycled in some magical place somewhere. There must be a machine somewhere that does that. That I'm trying to circumvent by helping people pause and really think about this stuff that we are completely surrounded with at all times, but without hopefully overwhelming people, that it's not, you know, you don't have to become paralyzed or freaked out or anxious or feel guilty. Like, it's not possible to be perfect, but it is possible to do quite a bit better in terms of consumption with some very basic practices that many people are actually already familiar with.
There's also the issue of plastic contamination. So much of our stuff is made from plastic, based on plastic, which I know earlier you were referring to how our consumption is very much linked to fossil fuel emissions, and that plastic has contaminated our oceans, microplastics. So that issue of plastic contamination, the lack of recycling, all of that ties into this this conversation about stuff, right?
It does. For me, it comes in at several points. It comes in that first step of have good stuff, which has a lot to do with how we're designing things. We had several objects in our shop where one tiny plastic part would break, a knob or a swivel neck, or had this little stuffed reindeer, and he was supposed to sing and dance, and the cog in his heart was plastic and was broken. And so for us, it was so frustrating because we would see it really was fixable, and it's just this one tiny part that's made of plastic.
And if the manufacturer had just used a slightly stronger material, maybe wood or metal, and exactly. I mean, and that's a case for things like dishwashers and refrigerators
Right, big objects. It's not just little reindeer.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much, Sandra, for joining us today. Where can people find out more about Fix Up, the repair shop that you helped to start in New York City?
So right now, because of the pandemic and because of the book, our repair shops are on hiatus. Mm-hmm. But people can go to sandragoldmark.com to learn more about our story. And they can also read the book, because all the repair shop goodies and tales and the how to have stuff without breaking the planet is all in Fixation.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you with the book.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Sandra Goldmark. She's the founder of Fix Up, formerly Pop-Up Repair, and the author of the new book that we've just been discussing, Fixation, How to Have Stuff Without Breaking the Planet. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
To KBOO Portland.
Support KBOO in this year's Give Guide. Just go to kboo.fm/give to donate. All new and increased donations will be matched 1-to-1 up to $25,000. So donate today. That's kboo.fm/give.
Hi, everyone.